Last week on Wine Chat, we covered the important role that yeast plays in winemaking. This week, we're taking a look at the other important microbes that are involved in winemaking and their potential negative effects to take us through what all this is and what's going on and all the good stuff. We love a little bit of microbe talk. It's Cal Lee. Cal, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing all right.
Excellent. We're getting real small this week. I think
getting really small. Yeah.
Really, really small. This is something that you literally can't see happening. You couldn't hold your bottle of wine up to the light and say, I don't like the microbes in this red. But you know, we're going to talk about it anyway. We're going to learn about it. So, what makes something a microbe, Cal?
Yeah. I mean, as we've sort of indicated, a microbe is something that you need a microscope to see. I sort of want to specifically try and bracket this week's conversation off to being about, we've sort of talked about yeast in the previous episodes, and there are a lot of different sort of microbes and microorganisms that have lots of effects in the vineyard, like your various mildews and your sort of cyanorrhea and stuff like that. And I don't really want to cover that today. I specifically want to sort of focus on the two main sort of types of bacteria we're sort of looking at today. And that's your Acetobacter and your Lactobacter, and sort of how they both have positive and negative effects at various points of the winemaking process. And then, you know, hopefully we'll have a little chat a little bit later about how you at home can actually tell if there's bacterial contamination in your wine.
Yes, because if we can't see the microbes, we can see their effects, obviously.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, as you were saying that, I just did a little bit of an unhinged Google search. I Googled, is microbe short for microbeing? I know it's short for microorganism, but I was wondering if microbeing came into the mix there. There's no
it's
scientific...
It's not a real, like, 60s sci-fi flair to it. It's just like, oh, attack of the microbeings.
Yeah. There is, just so we've got all of our bases covered because we're a very scientific program.
Exactly.
There is no scientific evidence to suggest that microbeing is the long form of microbe.
I'm glad we got that covered.
I'm all over it. I'm all over it this morning. Let's talk more about microbes. What kind of microbes do we find in ferments?
Yeah. So there's a whole host of sort of like different little bacteria and yeast that all exist in an active ferment. It's why a lot of times, especially in commercial winemaking, they'll go through sort of a few different processes to sort of drop the microbial count to basically a level that sort of can't arise again. It's also important to note that through the process of fermentation and the production of ethanol, a lot of the really, really nasty spoilage bacteria basically can't survive in those environments. It's why sort of wine became such an important agricultural product in, you know, 1000 BCE kind of thing, because it was sort of resistant to spoilage in that way. But there's sort of, in the ferment itself, there's, like I said, there's the Lactobacter or Lactobacillus, and we really like them because they turn sort of the harsher malic acids, think like green apple, sour candy, into the softer, creamier lactic acids. Think like, you know, yogurts and cheeses and stuff like that. And then you have your Acetobacter, and these guys are a little bit more controversial. They basically convert ethanol into acetic acid, which might sound a bit weird, but that's how we get vinegar. Really important for that, really important in things like kombucha and stuff like that. And once again, like when we talked about the Brettanomyces last week, there is an argument that a certain amount of Acetobacter in a ferment gives a particular quality that, whilst it might be technically regarded as a fault, especially in sort of the like formal New World wine judging criteria, it does give a certain sense of like a terroir expression or a specific sense of time and place that adds a little bit more complexity to a wine than just instantly being like, oh no, it's got like a slightly balsamic taste to it. This wine's terrible.
And what kind of microbes affect wine after a ferment?
Yeah, so I guess we sort of have two different stages here. While stuff is actively fermenting, we get a lot more microbial interactions going on there. But a lot of those things can either be processed out afterwards by, you know, various stabilizations and stuff like that. once we've sort of got a finished wine, that's when we're much more concerned about attack on microbes. So we sort of have various levels of not quite pasteurization. We're not quite going to that extreme, but, you know, processes that will help stabilize a wine against microbial contaminations. The really big one at this stage that a lot of people worry about is those Acetobacter, because, and you can, I mean, this will happen at home. If you leave a bottle of wine open on the counter for 2 weeks, it will start to taste like vinegar. That is just part of the process of having that much ethanol in an environment that can support them. So a lot of care is basically placed on making sure that a finished wine is in an oxygen-free environment or in a micro-oxygenated environment to stop sort of these Acetobacter from being able to colonize back in, and then they get rid of all that delicious ethanol that we've worked so hard to produce and then turn it all into vinegar, which, whilst vinegar is great in its own right, probably not what I want to spend, you know, $30 a bottle on.
Yeah, I mean, if you, I also don't want to spend $30 per bottle on vinegar.
I mean, I've had some nice vinegar, don't get me wrong, but it's like, you know, there's limits to these things, right?
How good can it be?
I mean, it can be pretty good. Anyway, we don't need to start talking about like the big champagne vinegars. That's a different show on a different radio network.
This is a wildly off-topic tangent to go on.
Yeah.
They just talked about vinegar. So how do I tell if a wine I purchased is showing microbial faults?
Yeah, I mean, I think the vinegariness thing, that is like a really super understandable. It's a thing I teach a lot when I'm sort of first teaching people to detect wine faults is, hey, like if you get a glass of a bottle that's been freshly opened and then the glass of something's been sitting out for 5 days, feel how the texture of the acid has changed. And a lot of times that will be that sort of Acetobacter stuff there. Another thing we're looking for a lot of times is haziness where there shouldn't be, or like dissolved gases. This is a little more complicated because yeast can also sort of produce these things. And especially this is also why at the start of sort of a lot of the natural wine movement, a lot of these winemakers were given a lot of grief because basically things that they were intentionally leaving in their wine made the wines appear to the end consumer to be like things that were then spoiled further on. But there's sort of three basic things you want to sort of be looking for. It is like, does it have that vinegary smell and taste? Is there sort of a haziness and a proteinous haze to it, which there's a lot of things that can cause that, but microbial spoilage is sort of a big indicator of that. And is there dissolved gases in the wine? Obviously, for sparkling wines, we kind of want a bit of dissolved gas in there. That is kind of the entire point of that. But, you know, if you're drinking your big Barossa Shiraz and it's gone a little bit fizzy, maybe you should be a little bit concerned about that.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, and then what are you drinking this week? What vinegar adjacent, almost vinegar liquid are you consuming this week?
I mean, something that is definitely not vinegar, but is very delicious. I'm in Nebbiolo territory at the moment, and I want to shout out the Oscar Herman Yarra Valley Nebbiolo. We sort of mentioned it in the Barolo episode a few months back, God, time. But, you know, Nebbiolo is finding a little bit of a home now in Australia, especially in sort of the higher altitude parts of Victoria. I think this is a really, really beautiful example of varietal. It is not quite there in terms of, like, the big, heavy, like, quite robust structures of, like, your classic Barolos. But I think it does show that real pretty florality. And I think it does have that really beautiful phenolic density that I find really, really pleasing, especially as a sort of lighter red as we're moving into the hotter months. It, I think a really, really fun way to have sort of something is that like big, more robust style of red wine without necessarily having the weight and the heaviness of something like a Shiraz or a Cabernet. That's what I'm shouting out this week.
I hope your Nebbiolo stays microbe-free, Cal, as you drink it.
So do I.
Do we have an idea of what we're doing next week, or is it going to be a surprise for both of us?
Yeah, I think we're going to sort of keep on this little microbial pathway, and we're going to talk about sort of microbes in the vineyard. And I definitely don't have a wine microbiology course that I'm starting to do revision for.
Surely not, no. This is... This is completely coincidental. It's just, you know, this is what you wanted to talk about this week. You're just not, forcing you to revise for exams.
Yeah. but yeah, we're going to be sort of talking about some stuff in the vineyards. There might be a few other little bits and pieces as we sort of move into December and there's a bit more free time on the show. There might be a few cool things popping up as well.
Cool. Can't wait to hear it. All right, Cal, all the best. I'll speak to you next week.
See you then, Cam.